Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm pleased to have as my guest Kem Nunn, the author most recently of Tijuana Straits. He is the author as well of Tapping the Source. Let me get this in the right order. Unassigned Territory, Pomona Queen, The Dogs of Winter. And this book represents what's said to be the latest entry in a genre he's created himself called surf noir. Now, do you feel comfortable with that name? Did you invent it?
Surf noir. Well, you know, those are the kind of names that people come up with that talk about books. You know, that as a writer, it's not much use to one. So I don't think about it in those terms, but I guess I can live with it. Mm-hmm. You know.
But what is true about the books is that somehow or other, Southern California seems to have inspired a certain kind of writing, whether that's Raymond Chandler or Ross McDonald. It's as if the place inspires a certain kind of ominous writing. And you've mentioned that your characters depend almost entirely upon place, that you know the place before you know your characters.
You know, in part, that the whole noir movement in writing kind of grew out of a response to all of that boosterism, you know, all of that. It was a writing against the myth. You know, a lot of those early noir writers were disenchanted Hollywood script writers who had, you know, come out here expecting to find the good life and instead found this, you know, rabidly anti-union town, found racism. You know, they looked into the shadows and saw the dark stuff. And they were compelled to write against the myth.
Did you grow up here?
Yeah, I did. My great-grandfather came out to grow oranges in the 1880s, and so I've been...
So were you going against the myth, or were you describing something you actually found?
Well, both, because having grown up in Southern California and having been drawn to the beach and drawn to surfing, certainly no one had ever, you know, I'm dialing the clock back now to the days of Tapping the Source when I first sat down to write something about the beach and about surfing. It just struck me that no one had ever written anything very real about it. There had been the beach blanket bingo movies, and there had been Gidget, and it was all sweetness and light, rather. And so I didn't think about writing against the myth. You know, and in the way that those, I didn't think about it as being part of a tradition, literary tradition, but I can look back on it now and see that in some ways I was doing both of those things you suggested. I was writing what I knew, but in writing what I knew, I was also writing against this myth.
Now, I'm curious because here in Tijuana Straits, there's a kind of mystical wave that occurs only ever so often, and also brought to bear is the mystique of the shaper, the person who makes the boards, who fits the plexiglass. I would imagine that with so much talk about shape and mysteries and mystique of shape, does that influence the writing of the novel?
It's an interesting idea. One does hold a novel in one's head as a fictional construct that does have a kind of shape to it, and you do construct a plot, and a beautiful board in a way is kind of to me like you know people talk about ships, boats as having some of them just have a shape that's pleasing to the eye. And you can see that in a board. A board has a certain kind of, you know, curve to the rail, a curve to the, you know, a way of that it, the rocker is fixed. And I don't, you know, and I do think about plot as having a certain kind of shape. I don't know.
This plot culminates in the arrival of that wave. Right. You know, it's a kind of surfer's paradise, and several different culminations occur at once. Mm-hmm. The villains in the book have come up to the Tijuana Straits Valley. This wave, presaged by a storm that's being tracked on the computer screen. The woman is being chased by the villain. Everything is converging. Yeah. And, you know, you sense that unless the writer does something pretty soon, perfection is going to be on our hands. And, of course, you do work to fight against. No sooner do these people get caught than you realize they're back where they started. it's very tense, but at the same time, they're debating about questions about life. Can you predict life the way the woman thinks that you might be able to predict the arrival of the wave? And the man says, no, you live it in the moment. The wave doesn't come just because you want it. You have to want it, but it doesn't come till it gets there. So it becomes the battle between these two major characters, too.
Yeah, well, in terms of the characters, I really wanted to set up just characters who have very different ways of looking at life. A woman whose life has always been defined in certain terms of some kind of struggle, with the guy whose life is in a way has been defined as a kind of flight from struggle, flight from engagement. Let's put it that way. Her life has been about engagement. His life has been a flight from engagement. It intrigued me to put these two characters together and see what happens.
Now, when you're inventing a character, the man here, Sam Fahey, he is as resistant to encounter as you can get. He's living on a property he's inherited from his father. Father, he's had differences with. But he's turned the back porch into his shaping studio. He's added a trailer. He hasn't been in the house in how long?
20 years.
20 years.
Like that, yeah.
And more than that, there's a sign warning that there are bees in the house. And he says, I think they're just in the... I think they're just in the dining room. At a certain point, he's going to go in, and it's almost like a costume scene from an old movie. He's going to find a dress for the woman. They're going to go out to eat. Mm-hmm. He's going to shave. They're going to be impressed with the way each other look. But how do you decide, I can convince a reader that this character has not been in his own house for 10 years?
Well, I think you have to somehow convince yourself. You know, you have to get yourself to believe it, and then I think if you believe it, you sort of take it on faith that maybe you can get others to go along with you.
Because I found I was willing to believe anything about these villains. They were so creepy, but the hero is a strangely moral guy. This is a story of redemption. He's an ex-con. He's fried on meth on the first page. And yet there's something like Jimmy Stewart lurking inside him.
Yeah, well, too bad Jimmy Stewart's not still around. We could. Some people, ask, why do you pick these kinds of characters? I get asked that question. It seems like all of your characters tend to be these kind of down and out. He's got the meth problem. He's got this kind of horrible past. And I guess I feel like, one thing that you're doing, several things when you write. One thing you're always doing, I think, is looking for access to your own experience. One thing you're always trying to do, I think, is somehow make palpable or visible that existential landscape that we all traverse, Each of us in our lives traverse our own kind of existential landscape that carries us through varying realms of shadow and light. And as a writer, you're somehow trying to make that visible on the page. And
well, these guys, what interests me about them is not their problem. It's that they share a kind of purity of soul that the action of the narrative functions to cause to reemerge. So it's as if this guy, having betrayed and failed people before, has it at heart to demonstrate that he will not betray and fail again, mm-hmm. becoming in the process, in the book's final pages, nearly a superhero. Because he's saved the woman.
Well, he does lose that fight, though.
but it's their goodness coming back that I find very moving mm-hmm. about these novels, in fact, from Tapping the Source on. They encounter a vile and violent atmosphere and are given the possibility of losing themselves over and over again, but they really do make a huge effort to come back together. Do you believe in the possibility of that kind of effort, or are these books meant to be almost exhortations to people who've lost themselves to give it the college try?
Well, I think that it's the former. I think that I must believe that that's, you know, because I think there's a, again, you know, there's a place where we're all kind of fallen, you know, and kind of up against it in a way in which we all fail a lot in life. And yet, you know, the idea that we can come back from that, that we can, you know, choose ourselves. I've always been drawn to that character, that character arc of the character who's died to the world and then finds some way of coming back into community, some way of coming back into the world.
By the way, I'm talking to Kem Nunn about his novel, Tijuana Straits. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. We're talking about the border between California and Mexico, but not just about that border. We're talking about the kind of industry that has despoiled the water and the land with industrial waste. And we're talking about, if I remember correctly, there's either a Chandler or a Hammett novel that takes place in a place called Personville, but everyone calls it Poisonville.
That's right. Yeah, Red Harvest.
That's right. And here, too, we're dealing with a place where the iniquities of corporations and the immorality of the land get symbolized by the pestilence and the disease being spread by industrial waste. And in fact, it's very interesting because in tracking down the perpetrators here, there are several possibilities. One is that they are representatives of the corporations. Mm-hmm. Another is that they're representatives of drug lords. And a third is that they are protesting the efforts of a woman's movement in a woman's building where abortion and independence, anti-battering action is taking place. It's almost as if both movements toward progress and movements that are severely detrimental to the populace are equally producing a kind of criminality that's going on in this book, so that we don't know good from bad.
Well, part of what drew me to the border area was reading those stories about the women of Juarez, because that's such a sort of labyrinth of a tale.
Tell me.
You know that story?
Since
1995 or something. There's been like 300 or 400 women who have been murdered in Juarez, and there's been lots of talk as to whether there's like a, you know, the mother of all serial killers on the loose, or whether it's a group of serial killers, and and no one's ever quite figured it out. But I was reading about that, and one of the things that was going on along the border is they bring in the factories employ all these young women, that leaves the young men unemployed. So not only are you messing with the environment, but you're messing with the social fabric of this place in a way that seems to have these dire consequences. And it intrigued me. I mean, it intrigued me on a couple different levels. What's going on there environmentally intrigues me because I've spent a fair amount of my time surfing and spent time in the ocean, and it bothers me that the oceans are becoming dirtier.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. So I was intrigued by what was going on environmentally, but I was also intrigued by the way in which the social fabric was being disrupted and what was going on at that level. So I decided to go down and take a look at what I think of as my border, Tijuana, and wound up spending a fair amount of time down there with there was one woman in particular, an attorney I spent time with in Tijuana. I spent time with some of these women. There's groups like Factor Eke, Casa de la Mujer. Spent time with some of these women, just seeing what they do. That was just something that I really wanted to, to have be a part of the story, the consequences of what's going on in those factories and the way people come to work and then what happens to the people that work there. I wanted all that to be a part of the fabric of the story.
Now, are you a birder, by the way?
No.
Because this book is so full of bird lore, and my favorite detail in it, now this villain is very scary, but my favorite detail is something that doesn't come into place. He's preparing a torture chamber for the heroine that he expects to bring her to, and he, in it, among its various equipment and such that he intends to use on her, he takes a dead owl and dresses it in baby doll clothes and puts it in a cage.
The doily on its head.
Yeah. Yes. Where did that come from?
I have no idea.
It's the scariest thing.
Well, it's weird. It's taxidermied things are always weird.
But I keep imagining your villain saying, okay, now I'm going to prepare the scary owl in baby clothes. That's going to really terrify her. And I know that, that in Psycho, there's that set of shots of all the stuffed
That's
birds.
Right.
They never really enter the pod. He's not defined, although we're implicitly told that he must have stuffed his mother the way he stuffed these birds.
Right.
But I wanted to talk to you about the creation of villains, because it seems to me in this book you're running a risk. How are you going to make a villain who is villainous but who doesn't seem to be consequently the target of racist activity on the part of the author?
By giving him a tragic dimension, I think. I wanted him to be, he certainly is a villain, not somebody you want to cross paths with. And yet he's also a product of this toxic environment. And in being a product of that toxic environment, he has his own, there's a kind of tragedy to his life. So that's how I see him. I see him as villainous, but also tragic.
In the sense that his wife has given birth to a dead child with a tumor,
right.
A huge tumor. So that in a way it's almost as if that owl in baby clothes is his dead child.
Well, there's a hospital in Reynosa that has a whole wing given over to the children of the factory workers, of those maquiladoras, babies born without brains, babies with these weird spinal conditions. It's such a toxic environment that this is one of the ways in which that toxicity manifests itself. And I went to one of the things I did when I was researching the book was I found out about a hearing down in San Antonio, Texas, and went down and where there were maybe 15 or 20 workers from various maquiladoras, I believe in Matamoros, that had come up to just tell their stories. It was a some policy arm of NAFTA was willing to sit and hear their stories with the idea that, you know, maybe they would be able to, you know, clean some of this stuff up. So it gave me an opportunity to meet up with a couple dozen people that had worked in those factories. And there were a couple of people in particular that told what I thought were very poignant stories. And one was a guy who told a story much like the one, what I repeat in the book, about the birth of his son and the ultimate fate of his son. There was another guy that told about becoming addicted to the solvents and glues that he worked with. Those things kind of went together in my mind.
That becomes my last question. Do you have a belief in the novel as an agent of social change?
You know, I don't. I tend not to think about it in those terms. I tend to just always sort of think about story. But you know, you want to write about stuff that concerns you, and if you're angry about something, you want to let that anger into a book. You know, whether or not, to what extent this will actually change things. I mean, I was writing one night coming home from Tijuana. I was writing with one of the women that I had spent some time with down there, a woman who had been a factory. She'd come up to work in the factories and then gotten out of that and was now working with one of the ecological groups. And we were coming back across the border on that ferry that, or not the ferry, the trolley that runs, connects Tijuana to San Diego. And she, you know, she was saying that the problems there seem so vast and seem so overwhelming that you wonder, well, how will we ever make a dent in any of this? And she was saying that a lot of the women that she had begun working with had just gotten discouraged and tired and dropped out. But she said for her to give up on that fight would be to give up her soul, you know, to give up a big piece of who she was. And it struck me as being a, you know, rather profound thing to say and to think, you know. And I think, you know, maybe writing novels that have some social or political dimension, it's always, you know, it's an act of faith.
Well, but, I thought about Tijuana Straits, you know, by my guest Kem Nunn, which was published by Scribner's, that, yes, you're entering a world that seems to be a world of crime, that is to say, something that happens between people. But you find yourself, in fact, in a world in which the people have been deformed by the corporate poisoning that has completely altered their lives, not just altered their lives, but made life and the idea of happiness almost impossibly different from what it once had been. So we're not talking anymore about a criminal action, we're talking about a society and its criminal morality. And that's what seemed to me to be very moving. It was as if your hero, who is an ex-con, has come back into a world much more criminal than the world that took him into prison. And he finds himself speculating about what, really, in what amount to the final months of his life, might amount to happiness.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good way of putting it. And it also speaks, I think, to your other question about the character of Armando and what, you know, if there's what has shaped him.
They are both victims of problems that lie outside individual decision. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, if you feel yourself to be living in an environment determined by the drug trade, as the hero is, or determined by industrial poisoning, as the villain is, they're both puppets dangling from the strings of social ills that are much larger than they are.
That's true, yeah. And yet one guy manages to sort of find his way back in and one guy doesn't, you know. And is that, you know, is that how much of that is just simply fortuitous and how much comes from some other place?
Well, there seems to be this strange belief in this book in redemption. The woman has been raised by nuns, mm-hmm. And the man's earthly reward is his placement in a rather silly monument called Surfhenge, right, where famous immortal surfers have their swizzle stick surfboards arranged in a circle and benches with their names on them that are shaped like guns or sticks. You call them guns, yeah, in this book. And yet you feel this man... If there's ever been a redemption in modern fiction, this man has redeemed himself. Was that very important to you, that before he gets off this globe, that he make good?
Yeah, no, that was completely important to me. Yeah, that was very important.
Is it a quest of your own?
It's a good question, you know. I think... I knew a guy once who, way back, who was studying New Testament theology and at one of the Claremont Graduate Center. You know, they have this. Anyway, I was at his house. I remember picking up a paper entitled "The Theology of Hope," and it was I can't quite do it justice, but the basic idea was that you know, there's all these things that we can't know. You know, we can't. We're surrounded in life by questions that we can never know the answer to. But at least we can hope, and we can sort of let that hope inform our lives. And so somehow, ever since then, I've that idea of the theology of hope has had some resonance for me.
Yeah. I've been speaking with Kem Nunn, author most recently of Tijuana Straits, published by Scribner's. Thank you, Kem, for joining me.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me.
It's a pleasure. You can read an excerpt from Tijuana Straits on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.